Chester Stone waited in his own office suite more than an hour, and then he called downstairs and had the finance director contact the bank and check on the operating account. It showed a $1.1 million credit, wired in 50 minutes ago from the Cayman office of a Bahamas-owned trust company. "It's there," the finance guy said. "You did the trick, Chief." Stone gripped the phone and wanted exactly what trick he had done. "I'm coming down," he said. "I want to go over the figures."
"The figures are good," the finance guy said. "Don't worry about it."
"I'm coming down anyway," Stone said. He rode the elevator two floors down and joined the finance guy in his plush inner office, entered the password and called up the secret spreadsheet. Then the finance guy took over and typed in the new balance available in the operating account. The software ran the calculation and came up exactly level 6 weeks into the future.
"See?" the guy said. "Bingo!"
"What about the interest payment?" Stone asked.
$11,000 a week, 6 weeks? Kind of steep, isn't it?"
"Can we pay it?" The guy nodded confidently.
"Sure we can. We owe two suppliers $73,000. We got it, ready to go. If we lose the invoices, get them to resubmit, we free that cash up for a spell."
He tapped the screen and indicated a provision against received invoices. $73,000 minus 11 a week for 6 weeks gives us $7,000 spare.
"We should go out to dinner a couple of times."
"Run it again, okay?" Stone said. "Double check." The guy gave him a look, but he ran it again. He took out the 1.1, ended up in the red, put it back in again, and ended up balanced. He canceled the provision against the invoices, subtracted 11,000 every 7 days, and ended the 6 week period with an operating surplus of $7,000.
"Close," he said, "but the right side of close."
"How do we repay the principal?" Stone asked. "We need 1.1 million available at the end of the 6 weeks."
"No problem," the guy said. "I've got it all figured. We'll have it in time."
"Show me, okay?"
"Okay, see here?"
He was tapping the screen on a different line, where payments due in from the customers were listed.
"These two wholesalers owe us exactly 1.173, which exactly matches the principal plus the lost invoices, and it's due exactly 6 weeks from now. Will they pay on time?"
The guy shrugged.
"Well, they always have."
Stone stared at the screen. His eyes moved up and down, left and right.
"Run it all again. Triple check." "Don't sweat it, Chief. It adds up. Just do it, okay?"
The guy nodded. It was Stone's company, after all. He ran it again, the whole calculation, beginning to end, and it came out just the same. Hobie's 1.1 disappeared as the blizzard of paychecks cleared. The two suppliers went hungry. The interest got paid. The payments came in from the wholesalers. Hobie got his 1.1 back, the suppliers got paid late, and the sheet ended up showing the same trivial $7,000 surplus in their favor.
"Don't sweat it," the guy said again. "It works out."
Stone was staring at the screen, wondering if that spare $7,000 would buy Marilyn a trip to Europe.
Probably not. Not a 6 week trip anyway. And it would alert her. It would worry her. She'd ask him why he was making her go, and he'd have to tell her. She was very smart. Smart enough to get it out of him one way or another. And then she would refuse to go to Europe, and she would end up lying awake every night for 6 weeks too.
The suitcase was still there, lying on the front lawn. There was a bullet hole punched in one end. No exit hole. The bullet must have gone through the leather, through the sturdy plywood carcass, and burned to a stop against the packed paper inside. Reacher smiled and carried it back to join Jody over at the garage. They left the Jeep on the blacktop apron and went in the same way they'd come out. Closed up the roller door and walked through to the breezeway. Locked the inside door behind them with the green key and walked through to the kitchen. Locked that door behind them and stepped past Jody's abandoned garment bag in the hallway. Reacher carried the suitcase into the living room. More space and more light there than in the den.
He opened the case and lifted the concertina files out onto the floor. A bullet fell out with them and bounced on the rug. It was a standard 9mm Parabellum, full copper jacket, slightly flattened on the nose from the impact with the old plywood, but otherwise unmarked. The paper had slowed it to a complete stop in the space of about 18 inches. He could see the hole punched all the way through half the files. He weighed the bullet in his palm, and then he saw Jody at the door watching him. He tossed the bullet to her. She caught it one-handed. "Souvenir," he said. She juggled it like it was hot and dropped it in the fireplace, joined him on the rug, kneeling hip to hip beside him in front of the mass of paper. He caught her perfume, something he did not recognize, but something subtle and intensely feminine. The sweatshirt was too big on her, large and shapeless, but somehow it emphasized her figure. The sleeves finished halfway down the backs of her hands, almost at her fingers. Her Levi's were cinched in tight around her tiny waist with a belt, and her legs left them slightly empty. She looked fragile, but he could remember the strength in her arms, thin but wiry. She bent to look at the files, and her hair fell forward, and he caught the same soft smell he recalled from 15 years previously.
"What are we looking for?" she asked.
He shrugged. "We'll know when we find it, I guess." They looked hard, but they found nothing. There was nothing there. Nothing current. Nothing significant. Just a mass of household paper, looking suddenly old and pathetic as it charted its way through a domestic life that was now over. The most recent item was the will, on its own in a separate slot, sealed into an envelope with neat writing on it. Neat, but slightly slow and shaky. The writing of a man just back from the hospital after his first heart attack. Jody took it out to the hallway and slipped it into the pocket of her garment bag. "Any unpaid bills?" she called. There was a slot marked pending. It was empty.
"Can't see any," he called back. "There'll be a few coming in, I guess, right? Do they come in monthly?"
He gave him a look from the doorway and smiled.
"Yes, they do," she said. "Monthly, every month."
There was a slot marked medical. It was overstuffed with receipted bills from the hospital and the clinic and sheaves of efficient correspondence from the insurance provider. Reacher leafed through it all.
"Christ, is that what this stuff costs?"
Jody came back and bent to look.
"Sure it is," she said. "Have you got insurance?"
He looked at her blankly. "I think maybe the VA gives it to me, at least for a period."
"You should check it out," she said. "Make sure."
He shrugged. "I feel okay."
"So did Dad,"
she said, "for 63 and a half straight years." She knelt beside him again, and he saw her eyes cloud over. He laid his hand on her arm, gently.
"Hell of a day, right?" he said.
She nodded and blinked. Then she came up with a small, wry smile.
"Unbelievable," she said.
"I bury the old man, I get shot at by a couple of murderers, I break the law by failing to report so many felonies I can't even count them, and then I get talked into hooking up with some wild man aiming to run some kind of a vigilante deal. You know what Dad would have said to me?"
"What?" She pursed her lips and lowered her voice into a close imitation of Garber's good-natured growl.
"All in a day's work, girl. All in a day's work."
That's what he would have said to me. Reacher grinned back at her and squeezed her arm again. Then he leafed through the medical junk and picked out a letterhead. "Let's go find his clinic," he said. There was a lot of debate going on inside the Tahoe about whether they should go back at all. Failure was not a popular word in Hobie's vocabulary. It might be better just to take off and disappear. Just get the hell out. It was an attractive prospect. But they were pretty sure Hobie would find them. Maybe not soon, but he would find them. And that was not an attractive prospect. So they turned their attention to damage limitation. It was clear what they had to do. They made the necessary stops and wasted a plausible amount of time in a diner just off the southbound side of Route 9. By the time they had battled the traffic back down to the southern tip of Manhattan, they had their whole story straight. It was a no-brainer, the first guy said. We waited for hours, which is why we're so late back. Problem was, there was a whole bunch of soldiers there, kind of ceremonial, but they had rifles all over the place.
How many? Obi asked.
Soldiers? The second guy said. At least a dozen, maybe 15. They were all milling around, so it was hard to count them exactly. Some kind of honor guard.
She left with them, the first guy said. They must have escorted her down from the cemetery, and then she went back somewhere with them afterward.
You didn't think to follow?
The way we could, the second guy said. They were driving slow, a long line of cars, like a funeral procession.
They'd have made us out in a second. We couldn't just tag on the end of a funeral procession, right?
How about the big guy from the Keys?
He left real early. We just let him go. We were watching for Mrs. Jacob. It was pretty clear by then which one she was. We stayed around, then she left, all surrounded by this bunch of military.
So what did you do then?
We checked the house, the first guy said. Locked up tight. So we went into the town and checked the property title. Everything's listed in the public library. The place was registered to a guy called Leon Garber. We asked the librarian what she knew, and she just handed us the local newspaper. Page 3, there was a story about the guy. Just died. Heart trouble. Widower. Only surviving relative is his daughter Jody, the former Mrs. Jacob, who is a young but very eminent financial attorney with Spencer, Gutman, Ricker, and Talbot of Wall Street, and who lives on Lower Broadway, right here in New York City.
Obi nodded slowly and tapped the sharp end of his hook on the desk with a jittery little rhythm.
And who was this Leon Garber exactly? Why all the soldiers at his wake?
Military policeman, the first guy said. The second guy nodded.
Mustered out with 3 stars and more medals than you can count. Served 40 years, Korea, Vietnam, everywhere.
Obi stopped tapping. He sat still and the color drained out of his face, leaving his skin dead white. All except for the shiny pink burn scars that glowed vivid in the gloom.
Military policeman, he repeated quietly.
He sat for a long time with those words on his lips. He just sat and stared into space, and then he lifted his hook off the desk and rotated it in front of his eyes, slowly, examining it, allowing the thin beams of light from the blinds to catch its curves and contours. It was trembling, so he took it in his left hand and held it still.
Military policeman, he said again, staring at the hook.
Then he transferred his gaze to the 2 men on the sofas.
Leave the room, he said to the second guy.
The guy glanced once at his partner and went out and closed the door softly behind him. Obi pushed back in his chair and stood up. Came out from behind the desk and stepped over and stopped still, directly behind the first guy, who just sat there on his sofa, not moving, not daring to turn around and look. He wore a size 16 collar, which made his neck a fraction over 5 inches in diameter, assuming a human neck is more or less a uniform cylinder, which was an approximation Obi had always been happy to make. Obi's hook was a simple steel curve, like a capital letter J, generously sized. The inside diameter of the curve was 4 3/4 inches. He moved fast, darting the hook out and forcing it over the guy's throat from behind. He stepped back and pulled with all his strength. The guy threw himself upward and backward, his fingers scrabbling under the cold metal to relieve the gagging pressure. Obi smiled and pulled harder. The hook was riveted to a heavy leather cup and a matching-shaped corset. The cup over the remains of his forearm, the corset buckled tight over his bicep above his elbow. The forearm assembly was just a stabilizer. It was the upper corset, smaller than the bulge of his elbow joint, that took all the strain and made it impossible for the hook to be separated from the stump. He pulled until the gagging turned to fractured wheezing and the redness in the guy's face began to turn blue. Then he eased off an inch and bent close to the guy's ear.
He had a big bruise on his face. What the hell was that about?
The guy was wheezing and gesturing wildly. Hobie twisted the hook, which relieved the pressure on the guy's voice box, but brought the tip up into the soft area under his ear.
What the hell was that about?
He asked again. The guy knew that with the hook at that angle, any extra rearward pressure was going to put the tip right through his skin into that vulnerable triangle behind the jaw. He didn't know much about anatomy, but he knew he was half an inch away from dying.
I'll tell you, he wheezed. I'll tell you.
Hobie kept the hook in position, twisting it every time the guy hesitated, so that the whole true story took no longer than 3 minutes, beginning to end.
You failed me,
Hobie said.
Yes, he did,
the guy gasped.
But it was his fault. He got all tangled up behind the screen door. He was useless.
Hobie jerked the hook. As opposed to what? Like he's useless and you're useful?
It was his fault, the guy gasped again. I'm still useful.
You're going to have to prove that to me.
How?
The guy wheezed.
Please, how? Just tell me.
Easy. You can do something for me.
Yes.
The guy gasped.
Yes, anything, please.
Bring me Mrs. Jacob, Hobie screamed at him.
Yes,
the guy screamed back.
And don't screw up again,
Hobie screamed.
No, the guy gasped. No, we won't, I promise.
Hobie jerked the hook again twice in time with his words.
Not we, just you, because you can do something else for me. What?
The guy wheezed.
Yes, what? Anything? Get rid of your useless partner,
Hobie whispered.
Tonight, on the boat.